Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. This is the first episode of a new season of Patron Deities, and we're going to be talking, based on your votes, about the Celtic mythology section of Deities and Demigods. And in a previous episode, I promised to begin this one by explaining why I'm not an enormous fan of the word Celtic. So, the Celtic mythos section begins by saying that the myths of the Celts are by no means confined to the British Isles. I'm not sure I agree with that, but it doesn't even matter because, as far as I can tell, this Celtic mythos section is entirely Irish. I don't think there's very much that comes from British mythology. Maybe we'll run into one or two things, but certainly the main sections all seem to be based on Irish mythology. And this is the kind of thing that we've encountered previously in the Norse mythology section. That is to say that there was a very common viewpoint. It was common in the 19th century, it was common in the early 20th century, and I think for a lot of people who aren't historians, it's still quite common today, which is that if two things have the same name, or if they're related in some way, then they must be the same. So a lot of people, when they look at, for example, the pre-Christian religions of Anglo-Saxon England, they go, oh, well, we know that they worshipped Woden. Woden is the same as Odin, and therefore we can know a lot about the religions of 6th century England based on what a medieval Christian thought religion was like in 10th century Iceland. And you can't, really, I don't think, or certainly, you certainly can't as much as these people would like to. And this is all based on this very pervasive idea that existed, again, in the 19th century. You have to think of the 19th century as a time of emerging European national identities, and that goes hand in hand with this interest in folklore, folk music, and pre-Christian religion. You know, what does it mean to be English? What does it mean to be German? And in particular, what do those national identities mean for nations that have kind of maybe had their national identities suppressed? If you are Ireland, and for a long time you've been colonized by Britain, or even if you're, you know, Scotland, and you want to not define yourself as a junior partner to England, right? So that Scottish culture is not an inferior version of English culture, it's a different thing. Indeed, I say the 19th, but actually there's a lot of this kicking around in the 18th century as well. You're going to start to get interested in the antiquities of those cultures. And those are going to connect to this relatively widespread view that sort of European history is all about the movements of, let's call them, peoples. This idea that there are certain peoples, you know, these are the Saxons, and those are the Irish, and these are, you know, whatever, there's these different tribes, and they all kind of move around, and as they go, they take their language and their beliefs and their culture with them, and they're more or less consistent. So you get people attempting to identify what are kind of the characters, the national characteristics of these peoples. And with that comes this big, broad generalization. So whenever you get someone that's described as a Celt, whether we're talking about people fighting the Romans in the hundreds BC or people arguing with the English about the date of Easter in the early Middle Ages, we're going to be viewing them with these generalizations about quote-unquote Celtic culture, even though these people are hundreds of miles and hundreds of years apart. So that's why I don't like the term Celtic. It's a generalization that encompasses cultures that are actually very diverse. Where we do encounter the term Celtic is mostly in linguistics. So there are a group of languages called the Celtic languages. So that term has kind of stuck around, but I think that very few archaeologists or ancient or medieval historians today would say that there was such a thing as a unifying Celtic culture. That there are obviously similarities between the different, what we would think of as Celtic nations or Celtic cultures or Celtic bodies of literature, but also that there are similarities between those and their other non-quote-unquote Celtic neighbors, and that the boundaries between these things in any direction may just be blurrier than we think they are. But for the purposes of this section, that doesn't really matter because it doesn't really look like Jim Ward has attempted to to generalize anything about European Celtic culture in this section. He hasn't mashed together the myths of different quote-unquote Celtic cultures, at least not at a first glance. Instead, what he's done is taken some sources about Irish mythology and just assumed that they apply to everywhere within the Celtic world, which I think, first, we're not super convinced the Celtic world is a thing, but secondly, even if it were, I don't think that would be the right thing to do. However, for our purposes, we can just treat this as a section on Irish mythology and proceed as normal. So anyway, naturally, we're gonna have druids in this. Now, I'm not aware that there are very good sources for druids, per se, in pre-Christian Ireland. The term is applied to the religious specialists of a pre-Christian era by Christian writers who were familiar with classical sources relating to druids in Gaul. But I speak subject to correction by anyone who's a specialist in Irish history. But anyway, they're druids. They're very close to nature. It says that the deities are dedicated to preserving nature, but also that they're maybe a little bit unscrupulous. Celtic gods are very tolerant of the actions of their priests as long as such actions further the sect. And I think it's very hard to read some of these stories in any way other than that, right? Because we're going to see a lot of these deities. This is going to be a bit more like Norse mythology, in that a lot of the time we're almost going to be looking at gods who are very human-like. Indeed, who are presented in many of these sources as humans. We're going to be talking about the Dagda in today's episode, and many of the sources that we have for the Dagda make it perfectly clear that he is a person, a human being. It's just that everyone seems to pretty much agree that that is because later Christian writers took these myths and were like, well, we can't really say that this guy was a god, so they must have been talking about a person. This is called euhemerization, when you take a figure who's supposed to be divine and portray them as a person. Again, the same way that Christian medieval writers did, like Saxo Grammaticus describes Balder as a person, like a particular king. So we get all the stereotypes that you probably have about Irish religion, Irish mythology, right? Druids are very spiritual, they're close to nature, they're different from clerics, it's not a hierarchical organized religion like a religion that has clerics. Maybe they're a little bit unscrupulous. But then also, interestingly, it says that druids are perceived as an elite class, which again, that's very much a Julius Caesar kind of thing to say. They're seen as above the ordinary worshippers. And then uses a real weird term. It says they do not mingle with others, which makes sense, and are only allowed to mate with worshippers within their sect, which is real strange. Mate with? Anyway, this is a bit of a shame because it kind of knocks the idea of an adventuring druid on the head, or at least it means that if you're playing a druid who is a priest of these deities and you're out wandering the world slaying dragons and going down into dungeons and stuff, then obviously you must be some kind of an odd duck, straying outside of your society's restrictions on what a druid can or can't do. And we're going to find lots of sources for druids being, or priests or what have you, being restricted in, like, they seem to be subject to a lot of kind of taboos. So that sort of makes sense. But also, we know that the gods are quite forgiving of people who violate taboos as long as it's within the overall service of the sect. So that leaves the PC druid who's out, you know, having adventures as a bit of a gambler, right? Like, well, the gods don't technically approve of any of this stuff. But if it works, they'd be willing to look the other way, which is a fun position to find yourself in if you're very concerned about your relationship with the divine. We're also told that druids have a bunch of different possible magical items, including torques and cauldrons, and that they have different symbols of their different ranks. They wear different robes to indicate their different ranks, and some information on festivals, including festivals where human sacrifices are offered. And we talked about human sacrifice in the last season as well. I don't know what the scholarly consensus is on human sacrifice in prehistoric Ireland. Now, there are examples of what appear to be kind of highly ritualized killings in the archaeological record. In fact, this summer I was in Ireland and I got to go and see, together with my wife, some of the bog bodies in the National Museum of Ireland. Whether we can tie this to this particular form of paganism, I think is debatable. And in a culture, like most ancient cultures, where religion permeates every aspect of life, the difference between a ritual sacrifice and, say, a judicial execution is pretty hard to define. I think we can say that the archaeological evidence sort of suggests that if you want to have human sacrifice in your quote-unquote Celtic religion, you can go ahead and have it, and if you want to leave it out or make it very rare, then you can do that too. Again, as always, we're not looking for a historically accurate reconstruction, we're looking for inspiration for a fantasy role-playing game, and sometimes that means taking the more sensationalistic versions of the cultures that we're studying here. It's just that the real thing is full of frustrating ambiguity. So, we've got a society of druids, we know the druids are protected by a bunch of taboos, and they seem to be kind of like highly ritualized. That's kind of nice, right? I complained about the restrictions that it places on people, but on the other hand, it definitely moves away from the more common, I think, stereotype of druids, which is that they're very accessible and down-to-earth as compared to clerics. Portraying druids as weird mystics, I think, goes some way toward restoring that balance and almost makes them more interesting. You know, druids as sort of omnibenevolent hippies, that's the least interesting possible version of a druid, because a cleric at least has some kind of internal conflict a lot of the time. Some conflict between their own conscience and the dictates of their religion, whereas druids seem to have far fewer dictates. So here we're putting some rules back into druidry, and I think that's no bad thing. So with that in mind, let's take a look at our first deity in this section. And the first deity is a humdinger. I'm talking about the Dagda, or just Dagda, as he's called here, but more typically the Dagda. The Dagda is a great character. He's a god king, a god of agriculture, a god with sort of superhuman physical powers, almost like a Hercules figure in some ways, like a figure of primal, somewhat brutish strength, often depicted with a great big club. He has a magic club or staff. Depends on your translation. He's got a magic cauldron. Basically, he's extremely well kitted out. Performs great feats. Lots of, like, landscape features named after him. So, as usual, the Dagda is the 400 hit point head of the pantheon. And it says that he's the ruler of a very loose pantheon, which I think is fair enough. He can shape change, got telepathy, legend lore, and it says here, he's fond of walking the earth in the form of a shabbily dressed man with a large club. And the shabby dressing comes from, among other sources, certainly it's in the medieval Irish text, the Second Battle of Moytura. The Dagda is sent to visit the camp of the Fomorians, who you may recall from a recent episode of Monster Man, on the eve of battle. And the Fomorians, sort of to trick him or make fun of him, make a huge amount of porridge. And they're like, oh, well, we know you love porridge so much, Dagda. You must eat all this porridge. And they dig a big hole in the earth and they fill it with this horrid, fatty porridge. And they're like, you have to eat all this porridge or else you'll be accusing us of being inhospitable. Why there being too much porridge for him to eat would make them inhospitable, I don't know. And you'd think that if he ate all the porridge, then he'd be saying they were inhospitable because there wouldn't be enough porridge. But anyway, the Dagda is more than equal to the task. He has a special ladle, which is big enough for a couple to lie down in the bowl of it, it says. And he eats up all the porridge, and then his belly is all huge, and he goes wandering off home with his massive club and his big belly swinging to and fro. And it describes him as being all sort of like shabbily and weirdly dressed, like his tunic is too short that it barely covers his butt, and so on and so forth. And some have suggested that this is like, again, these are Christian writers trying to turn someone who was once a figure of primal power into a portly figure of fun. And we've seen similar things in Norse mythology as well, right? We've seen that Thor is often presented as a comic figure. But I don't know. Comic figures are endearing, right? Hercules is often presented as a comic figure by people who believed in him. So I don't know. I mean, and that's actually one of the things that makes me, that made me think of Hercules when I thought of the Dagda. I mean, the club for one thing, and the great physical strength for another, but also this sort of sometimes being somewhat ridiculous. So I'm using an online translation that's hosted by University College Cork, and it's a bit old-fashioned. It's, as I said, the eve of battle with the Fomorians, and Lu is going around and talking to each of the different warriors or leaders in his army and asking them what they're going to do in the battle with the Fomorians. Like, what special powers do you have? And he says, And thou, O Dagda, saith Lu, what power canst thou wield on the Fomorian host in the battle? Not hard to say, quoth the Dagda. I will take the side of the men of Erin, both in mutual smiting and destruction and wizardry. Their bones under my club will be as many as hailstones under the feet of herds of horses. Well, all right. That sounds pretty good. Oh yeah, he also has a magic harp. I forgot about that, because his harper gets kidnapped by the Fomorians. And that is the harp in which the Dagda had bound the melodies so that they sounded not until by his call he summoned them forth. So he sings to the harp, he summons it, and it says, then the harp went forth from the wall and kills 9 men and came to the Dagda. And he played for them the 3 things whereby harpers are distinguished, to wit, sleep strain, and smile strain, and wail strain. Through that sleep, the 3 of them escaped unhurt from the Fomorians, though these desired to slay them. So he's got a magic harp that can put people to sleep to go with his magic club and his magic cauldron. I mean, this is some top shelf magic items here. Mind you, it says here that his harp, in the D&D version, his harp can control weather, which is fine too, I guess. Cauldron enables him to brew any non-magical liquid or food. That's fine. And with his club, he says he's got if he touches something with the large end, it dies. And if he touches something with the small end, it comes back to life. So all of these are pretty terrific magic items to include in your campaign. Maybe that club that automatically kills anything and then brings anything else back to life. That's maybe a little too good to leave in the hands of player characters. But I thoroughly recommend, the Sleepy Harp. I think we're going to get some good stuff for bards in this section, actually, which is nice, because usually they get pretty short shrift. Anyway, the Dagda is pretty good. You can see that he's a deity who's full of kind of vitality, I guess I would say. You know, we see a lot of him, like, eating a big meal and then falling asleep, getting into a fight, busting people's heads. He does a lot of building things. He's sort of, when the Fomorians are misruling, they kind of enslave him and he has to build all of these fortresses, you know. So he's a bit like a giant in that respect. There's sort of there's a reference in here to this, like a road or valley being formed by the Dagda dragging his club behind him, right? That's where this sort of trench came from. So it's got that kind of Paul Bunyan-esque quality about him. Okay, I understand why they say the harp controls weather. The Dagda playing his harp is said to, like, be responsible for the procession or changing of the seasons. So I guess that, you know, in D&D terms, that translates into controlling weather. So that's pretty good, too. So I think that if you were playing Now, obviously, druids are druids, but I feel like if you were a druid devoted to this guy, then you're definitely kind of focused on, like, the raw vitality of life. You can definitely see this being, you know, I mean, he's got the healing thing, that's something that druids can do. He's got weather magic, that's a very druidy thing to do, you know, but at the same time, he's not afraid to get stuck in and bust some heads with his staff if need be, which, again, all pretty, like, these are all druidy things. But you can also see a cleric of the Dagda being, you know, kind of a larger than life sort of a character, a bit like back when we talked about Guan Di in the Chinese mythology section. He's an interesting example of a god who is strong and who is good at fighting, but is not primarily a war god or even a warlike god, right? He's in this battle because his entire community is in it. You can definitely see that clerics or paladins of the Dagda would be kind of populist in their outlook, which is nice. And you see how weird this is? Like, this is what I really like about Irish mythology, that it's just, it exists in some kind of cultural context that we mostly don't share. But so he's a very good example of the kind of mixture of familiarity and strangeness that we're going to see in this whole section, you know? Oh, a kind of agrarian king god who embodies the raw and primal strength of life and nature. Sure, makes perfect sense. But then there are also these weird touches, like his magic harp kills 9 Fomorians, apparently by itself? You know, does it slice them up with the strings? Like, it's a mystery. Like a cheese grater. Yes, it is a mystery. Anyway, I think that's a pretty good start for this section on Celtic mythology, and I'm looking forward to exploring some more of these deities next time on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.